On the Subcommittee on Healthcare Access.
Thanks to this guy.
Of the Healthcare Committee. Of the House Committee on Healthcare to order. And do we have Representative Butler here? Yeah, we do. I open a public hearing on House Bill 2717 and call Representative Butler to the witness stand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Representative Tom Butler from House District 60 in southeastern Oregon. This bill comes about as a placeholder to make sure that we get everything done that needs to be done relative to small family practices in rural areas of Oregon. Particularly, it deals with seeing if we can't get folks board certified on a more rapid basis, and I know that there are some concerns about the health of Oregon citizens if we do move forward and try and have folks board certified. Basically, the concept is that if someone is practicing or finishing up medical school in another state and they come to Oregon, and while they're in Oregon, they are able to present a credential that they are of good standing and having been board certified in another state, they're not under any sanction. That the balance of their application appears to then be in order, that they would be offered a provisional license if they agree to practice in rural Oregon, in one of those distressed rural communities that you're familiar with. The idea and concept is that it shouldn't take months and months to get board certification. And I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge that, in fact, the Board of Medical Examiners has done a number of things to accommodate rural health practices in rural in eastern and southeastern Oregon, including, number one, having more frequent board meetings. They've gone from quarterly board meetings to consider these applications, clear up to the point where they actually can meet weekly, using the modern miracles of telecommunication to consider applications for new physicians in the state of Oregon. And number two, if they find that the application, the applicant themselves is applying for a rural Oregon hospital to practice in a rural Oregon community where we are medically distressed and underserved, but they will move that application to the top of the pile. So I'm already reporting to you that there have been many very positive, very excellent changes in the way the process is moving forward. And as I say, that's why we've got a placeholder bill here. The BME have been very excellent to work with us to try and see what they could do. My next step is just to say that for those physicians who are practicing already in another state, that if they are practicing in another state, we need them in Oregon. We need them to take care of our medically underserved areas. If they are willing to come to a medically underserved area in the state of Oregon and they hold a license that is not being subject to sanction in the other state, they can bring us their state license from the other state and something from their medical board saying that they are not under any current sanction then from that other state, that on a very rapid basis the BME would issue a provisional license, and then they will go about the process of trying to determine whether or not that person smoked marijuana in high school or not. So at that particular point,
didn't inhale.
That's right. May have been in possession but didn't inhale. But it is important that they be of good character. It is important that they are in fact qualified physicians and surgeons as they come to Oregon. The concern is that if we could fast track those that particularly want to come to practice in medically underserved areas, if they can present the basic credential with the basic information that they are in good standing and not subject to sanction, that there could be a provisional license that the BME could then issue again, I would be remiss if I didn't say that they had in fact been working with us and trying to accommodate us. But these hospitals in these medically underserved areas, quite honestly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, still feel like that the BME could be more responsive and could be issuing provisional licenses on a more rapid basis. And with that, I would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Is this an attempt to get more plastic surgeons in Ashland? Is that the...
I beg your pardon, Mr. Chair.
Never mind. I withdraw the question.
Better that I missed that.
Are there any questions? Representative Butler, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate it. We have another representative to testify on another bill, but let's see how long we're going to take on this one. If Representative Gillen, you don't mind waiting a few minutes to... Yes. Ms. Haley? Will you join us, please?
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Medical Examiners. And while we have worked closely with Representative Butler, we do oppose this bill because we believe that we shouldn't have a lower standard of scrutiny for those physicians and other healthcare practitioners who want to practice in rural Oregon versus those who want to go to urban areas. The board does recognize that it's difficult to attract physicians and other health professionals to some of the more remote areas, and we want to continue to work with legislators on setting up some processes that will speed up the applications. One that we've worked on with legislators this session is the volunteer emeritus license. For those who are from out of state and want to come in and do volunteer work, we've set it up through the administrative rule process that they don't have any fees to pay and they're able to get licensed more quickly. We have seen in the last couple of years a 25% increase in the number of applicants for licensure, and to that end we did ask for another position which through the Ways and Means Committee has been approved. This would help to expedite our licensing. In addition, we are trying to improve the flow of communication back and forth, and one way in which we've done this is through an online status report. So once we get the application for licensure from the physician, we assign them a number, and then they can check through that number to see what documents are missing in their application process. The board did win a national award for that online status report, and it's the first state in the country to have such a report. We also set up a call center to triage some of the phone calls, because on an application you can get the applicant calling, you can get their future employer, their spouse, and credentialing people. And we were finding that our staff who were actually processing the applications were also having to answer all those calls. So we separated those out. Probably two things stand out as most advantageous for this process, and one is the express licensing that Representative Butler mentioned, and we've processed over 1,500 applications that way. And the other is the portability project. There's a national group, the Federation of State Medical Boards, and we're working to set up regional ways of accepting one another's licenses. We're in the early stages of this. We've gotten some federal money to initiate this. We're going to use technology to expedite that as well. I think in a lot of ways the board is between the paper and electronic world, and we've started to move more and more into the electronic world with sharing information state to state electronically, and I think this portability project will also get us further. So given that, we are going to have to oppose the bill, but we will continue to work with legislators, continue to try to move these applications through quicker. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, first question is, how many physicians does the board believe we are short in the state of Oregon?
Mm-hmm. Chair Greenlick, Representative Moore, that's a good question. I was just looking at our totals, and we probably have about 10,000 active practicing physicians in the state. In the rural areas, there is a definite shortage of, particularly in the specialty area. And so it's difficult to make that measurement.
Primary care?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Moore, primary care is less of a problem in the rural areas, but I got a call yesterday, frankly, from a physician in Chiloquin who said that he's desperate for a family practice physician. So, again, it's hard to measure, but particularly in the specialty areas, there are shortages in the rural areas.
And the average age of a physician in the state of Oregon?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Moore, I would have to get back to you with that.
Okay.
Thank you. Ms. Avery, how long does the Express... I'm a physician.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dying to come to John Day, and I send you my material, and I have my application complete. How long does it take under the Express process to process that?
Chair Greenlick, 5 days. 5 business days.
So it would be essentially the same requirements in the application that this bill would call for a temporary license?
Chair Greenlick, the problem that we have with the provisional is that then the applicant will actually have to do 2 applications, and we used to do that. We had a limited license special because the board did license on a quarterly basis.
No, I was asking a different question.
Oh, okay.
Question
I'm sorry,
asking
I thought...
is the material that would be required here for you to issue a provisional under this statute were it passed, would that be different than the packet of material that would qualify a physician for an express decision?
Chair Greenlick, the answer is yes.
And what's the difference?
With this provisional license, as I understand it, it would be simply the application and the fact that the physician had a valid license in another state. So there wouldn't be the kinds of verifications of documents that we would ordinarily do, such as exam scores, verifications of employment. If the physician had multiple licenses in many states, it's possible they would be under investigation in one of the other states.
Well, then let me try this again, because the five-day answer obviously wasn't the right answer. I'm saying from the time you get the physician's material,
correct,
which would be the same as is in here, how long does it take before you get that material and the express process grants a license? Having done all the things you did, checking multiple licenses, checking employers, doing all those things, how long is that time?
If I understand the question, Chair Greenlick, it's 5 days. Under the provisional license, there's less material that would be asked for. But it could still take five. I suppose if the question is, how long would it take us once we got the provisional materials? Probably about 5 business days.
Well, I'm not sure we're... It says under this, submitted an application for licensure under ORS 677120. Now, you said once that happens, you have a lot of checking to do. You check their scores, you check their multiple licenses, you check their employees. You do that in 5 days?
Chair Greenlick, you asked me once everything is complete. That's
no.
Once all the checking has been done.
I'm
once
asking,
all the materials...
I'm not asking once everything's complete. I'm asking once they've given you the application.
Then it's... Once the application, then all the materials are coming in on a rolling basis. They don't submit one packet with everything in the packet. They submit the application form, and then the other documentation is coming in on a rolling basis. Chair Greenlick, some of these materials come from other sources, from the national boards. That's where we get the exam scores. From the hospitals where they worked, we would get their employment verifications. So these documents are coming in on a rolling basis.
Okay. Let me try the question one more time. I'll see if I can switch to English this
time. Okay.
Once somebody gives you the application, as it says here, the application, how long does it take to get them licensed? Assuming that other material has to come, that things roll, that you and all those other things, the answer can't be 5 days. So let's try a different answer.
Then from the time of the application, it takes them about 2 months to get all the materials in.
And
60 days.
2 months and 5 days. So a provisional application would essentially save a couple of months.
Assuming we got the materials from the other state to say they were verified there, yes.
Okay. The follow-up, locum tenens, how long does it take to to allow locum tenens to practice in the state of Oregon?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Moore, they go through the regular application process. Once they have been licensed, they just notify us. They could fax us and say, I'm coming in next week, and there's no time problem there.
Okay. So it's not a different kind of licensing procedure. Why would I do a locum tenens?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Moore, because you don't intend to practice in Oregon all the time, consistently. Maybe you live in Idaho and you want to come in a couple of days a month.
So it's less expensive for me?
No, it's the same price. But it is a way of knowing where the physician is practicing.
Okay. Thank you. There are no other witnesses?
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on HB 277-2717. Okay. We have a bunch of legislators here. Okay, what I'll do. I'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2015 and a public hearing on 3492. And I'll ask the legislative sponsors to start us off on those, and then we'll go back to our regular process. Representative Gilliam, Representative Barnhart, could you join us? You can testify only on the bill that you've introduced, or you can testify on both of them if you want. It's age before beauty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District
11. Usually when I say that, I can't get anybody to talk, Phil.
Yes. Well, I accept reality as it exists, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the comment. I am here primarily to talk about House Bill 2015, and I should note that the purpose of this bill, the essence of this bill, is that it would require the Board of Medical Examiners, which I take it will soon have a new name, to publish and provide the legislature an annual report of professional negligence claims made against licensees. Require the board to post the report on its website and make the report available to the public upon request. It also requires that the details of the claims made not be disclosed, that is, the identities of the licensees not be disclosed in this report. And the bill is designed to allow the legislature to evaluate some of the reasons that are involved in the escalating costs of malpractice insurance premiums. And also whether or not the negligence is the result of a few doctors. This report itself doesn't address any problems. It simply is a way of revealing information. Negligence claims are already required to be reported by insurance companies to the board. This simply requires the board to be a conduit to pass the information along. I believe the legislature has a need for the information to help us evaluate medical negligence claims in our state and improve availability of knowledge to the legislature and to the public about these issues. In the past sessions, this issue has been a hot button one, and when I asked for information of the kind that this bill suggests be provided, I was told in past years that the cost of providing that would be in the neighborhood of hundreds or thousands of dollars. I do not recall the exact amount that I was told, but it seemed to me that it was excessive and unreasonable, and I believe this kind of information ought to be available to the public anyway, hence the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Since we have some similar issues in these two bills, why don't we let Representative Gilliam go ahead, and then maybe we can talk to both of you at the same time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and colleagues. It's a pleasure to follow the more seasoned and handsome representative.
Thank you, Representative.
I'm pleased to be here today and talk about 3492, and also to discover perhaps some similar issues in 2015. I don't pretend to be an expert on either, but I think I'll benefit from the testimony about both. I should for the record, say that I am Representative Vic Gilliam from District 18, Malala and Silverton. And as many know, I was appointed to serve the term of Max Sumner, the former representative, who became ill, and our prayers are with he and his family. I mentioned Max Sumner especially because this bill, 3492, is sort of a bill that I inherited from Mac, and I discovered its existence 3 days before bill drop deadline in this session, when a constituent of mine, Brenda Ross, who's here with her husband, and you'll hear from her in just a few moments, came to my office with the LC draft. Because of Mac's situation, I just wasn't apprised. And because of my own inexperience, I wasn't really sure how to proceed. So in many ways, my constituent was my mentor. And I say that because we had very little time to move ahead. And I guess the specific thing that I want to say is about her. I don't want to steal her thunder. I want her to tell you her story and her impetus and her energy for this bill in her own words. But this bill is a testament to somebody who saw an injustice. And even though her situation, as you will hear, really doesn't, hers is sort of decided. And she had no real benefit from this bill herself, but she just felt that it ought to be addressed. And I think you'll see in this whole area of complaints with the medical examiner board that something should be done, and I hope this bill addresses that. So it's a testimony to her sense of justice. It's a testimony to her tenacity in that she went and found many of you and other of our colleagues and got you on that bill back and moved this forward. And I'm very proud that she's here today and that I could at least in that way introduce her. And I want to thank you especially for hearing this bill, because I think it's a very important issue.
Are there any questions of our two fine representatives?
I have one. Please. Mr. Chair, this is for Representative Barnhart on 2015. I'm trying to see if there's any minimum or any definition as to when a complaint would have to be disclosed. My understanding is that the Board of Medical Examiners has kind of a threshold amount that, and I may have that wrong, but I'd heard like $100,000, or that there's a disclosure after a claim has been resolved, maybe by judgment. I don't know where it stands right now, so I'm just wondering, what is the intention, as far as you're concerned, on what is disclosed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson. I think that looking at Section 1 of ORS 742.400, which is printed in the bill, actually it is the section of the bill at this moment, the one being added by the bill, describes the information that insurance companies are required to provide to the board. And the intention, my intention, was not to require the board to extrapolate that in any way, just simply to accumulate it in the ways suggested on page 2, lines 4 through 7, and report it. And it doesn't specifically say so, but the board could devise a system of numbering or something like that that would provide this information without revealing the identities of the particular licensees who the complaints were about, or the claims were about. Recognize that these two bills are about different things. This bill is about negligence claims made to insurance companies. The other bill is about complaints, ethical complaints made to the board. So they're different. They arise from different issues. The reason why the board has the capability of reporting on claims filed with insurance companies is because of ORS 742.400, which requires insurance companies to provide that information to the board.
I'm not sure you have an exact interpretation on the second bill, but the real question is, in both these cases, is that the public are interested in being able to find out information, and I'm intrigued with the one model that doesn't disclose identity. I can't look on that website and find out whether my physician has had negligent claims against him. And spirit, at least, of the other one, which is to be able to allow people about to select a physician to get information about the extent to which there have been complaints of various kinds, and we can refine that. Would you like to comment on the difference between the personally identified one and the not personally identified one?
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, I would like to take a crack at it. The purpose, the reason that I drafted ORS 20.15 the way I did was because I did not want to require the legislature to consider a change in policy around the confidentiality rules that now exist in the way in which boards handle complaints or issues involving licensees. The current rule, as certainly the chair knows, and I think other committee members may as well, is that information, identifiable information, is released to the public only at the point, in some cases, in some boards, in connection with situations in which an emergency may have arisen, but in most cases, when an adjudication is final, and there is a final final order. And regardless of what the name of that order is, a final order by the board in which that issue is adjudicated. At that point, it becomes public information, and anybody can ask about it and receive information about it. I didn't want to take on the issue in 2015 of changing that policy. House Bill 3492 definitely takes on that policy and asks you to change that policy. So that is one significant difference between the two bills. I think, given the kinds of issues that this committee is facing, a review of that policy is not unreasonable. But I didn't address it directly in the bill.
Any other?
Thanks, Chair Greenlick. And I don't know who to ask this to, whether staff, you, or the presenters of these two bills, but this is not an area that I have any background knowledge in at all. And so I appreciate the clarification you just gave, Representative Barnhart, but what I know, if somebody has been remiss in their duties as an educator, you know, a complaint is filed and it goes to a certain board, but that complaint is, I mean, the issues around it and that person really aren't ever made public. I mean, somebody can call and check the person's background if they're going to hire them again, but I guess I'm surprised at making something so public. And so I don't know if that's normal or...
No, I think it's... I'll answer. I think as Representative Barnhart suggests, the policy is that you don't do it now
right. Until
something gets all the way at the end of the process and there's an order against that person. The board has adjudicated negligence or ethical violations or some other kind of issue. And that means when somebody calls the board, and we'll hear some testimony on this in a couple minutes,
right. Calls
the board and says, I'm thinking of using Dr. X. Have you had any complaints against Dr. X? And we'll also hear some testimony how the board answers that question. But it's basically, no, we don't have anything to tell you. Something like that. And we'll hear specifically from Ms. Haley about what that answer is. And the public takes that. I mean, there might have been 10 complaints against the physician, 3 of which may have had merit, 7 of which didn't have merit. The 3 of which had merit were settled some way.
Okay.
And there's no way to get any information that there's been 10 about that physician and none about Dr. Y. So some of this is some, you know, we're in this transparency era now, and there's some urge to make some of this information more available to consumers of medical care. And I think that's the thrust in all these. And it is, as Representative Barnhart says, taking on a major change in the policy that we face.
Mr. Chair.
May I add to that?
Cannon next? Yeah. Representative Cannon?
May I add to that comment, Mr. Chair?
You're here to be a witness.
Thank you. The point of 2015 was not to provide additional information to consumers about a particular physician. It was to provide information basically to the public and to the legislature as policymakers. Now, it could be easily converted with minor amendments to a bill that would provide the kind of information the chair's referring to. It's apparent from the context, from the text of it, that House Bill 3492 was intended to do exactly that.
Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Barnhart, I think you just answered the second of my questions about whether this was primarily designed to be a consumer tool or a policy tool. But I do have a follow-up, which is, as a potential policy tool, what might be the policy implications? What might the legislature and the public do with this data of sort of aggregated claims?
I think in order, if I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, I think I may have to give a little bit of history. In the last several sessions of the legislature, I think not including this one, there have been a lot of discussion about the way in which liability lawsuits were handled vis-a-vis physicians. A number of different suggestions were made, including things like capping liability and so forth. One of those suggestions involved without getting into the details, a situation in which knowing the kinds of information that I've described in 2015 might actually be very helpful in lowering the overall costs of liability for physicians in the state overall. And when I inquired to get that information, I got the results that I told you about. That was the impetus for it. Now, the situation hasn't changed. The liability issue is still there. It's still a real one. This information would still be beneficial in addressing those issues.
Okay, thank you very much. And a follow-up, Mr. Chair? It's a, I guess, a separate question. I got confused and sort of headed down the wrong track with this bill as you presented it because I sort of ignored the fact that this was really about claims related to potential malpractice, but the reporting requirement is on the liability insurance company. It's not as if the claim is made to the board directly. The claim is made to the insurance company. Could you just describe for us the path that the complaint takes? Because I've never been involved in one of these, haven't studied the issue. So how does the complaint go?
Well, thank you. And Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cannon, the way these kinds of things work, and others who are medical doctor physicians may be able to explain this in a slightly different way, but the way it works in many professions is that someone believes they have been injured as a result of malpractice or professional negligence on the part of a professional. They make a claim either through an attorney or directly with that person. With that professional. The professional has a liability insurance policy to cover professional liability and has a contract with the company that provides that to report these kinds of complaints to the company immediately. Now, under the statute that I referred to and that's in the bill, those claims, a written request for payment for injury alleged to have been caused by professional negligence that's made on behalf of the injured party to an insurer, or a written notification to the insurer by an insured person that requested payment from the insured for an injury alleged to have been caused by the professional negligence, leads to a claim. And that claim is required by the insurance company, then is required to report that claim to the, if it involves a physician, licensed by the Board of Medical Examiners to the board.
Under current law?
Under the law as it exists today.
Right.
And then, of course, the normal course of those kinds of claims is that they're adjudicated in the normal manner. Lawyers gather information. They do discovery. If they don't reach an agreement to settle the case, there's a complaint filed. At that point, of course, the matter becomes public because complaints are public. That is, the filing in court is a public document for the most of the time. Sometimes it isn't under special requests. And then it goes through the normal jury trial system that I suspect you are familiar with.
Mr. Chair, if I may, it's not clear to me why this 742-400 exists and requires the board to be notified when there is a claim. The board doesn't take any action. It doesn't adjudicate. If there is a doctor is found guilty of malpractice, then of course that's going to affect future licensure, which the board is responsible for. But I'm missing.
You can ask the board director when she gets here. Will she be here shortly about that?
Good question. Excellent.
It's an excellent question.
Yeah.
Councilor Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make a comment about the importance of this whole issue. It's about transparency, and as you had mentioned, when the public calls and they're told, "I'm sorry, we can't release that information," it looks like an inside deal where the system is protecting its own against the benefit of the people. Now, in the last couple of years, I've under the impression that the Board of Medical Examiners is making great strides toward disclosure and so forth, but they're still limited by the law. When you're dealing with the Bar Association and you wanted to find out if a certain individual would be a lawyer you'd want to hire or not, you can make a phone call to the Bar Association and they'll tell you every complaint that's ever been filed against that attorney, if any, and what the results were. And that way you can know and make an educated decision as to whether the results were the kind of thing that would be a normal outcome or not. Anybody can make a complaint, but it's how it results, how it's resolved. That hasn't been the case with doctors, and they say, well, it's because it's very personal, it's medical. Well, a person's financial life is very personal as well, and so it's time to have a look at this and see what is going to be best serving the citizens so that they can make an informed decision about who they're going to retain to entrust very, very personal things, whether it's their body or their finances or their legal issues or whatever. And so this is a move toward greater transparency so people can make an informed decision.
Great. Well, thank you both very much for coming and taking the time and leading off.
The other comment, if I can, Mr.
Yes,
Chair, would
please.
Be to pick up on Vice Chair Richardson's comment is both are important, in my view, and picking up on this bill. 3492 moves more into the urgent because of the individual case, which you'll see in a moment through the testimony that you've alluded to. And I think I'm with you, Representative Comp. This is a new area to me, but I think the difference here, when we're talking about teachers, it's a consumer who has an urgent need to know, and there are all kinds of issues regarding respect for the profession, certainly, but there are communications issues and appropriate use of technology that's a website that's much quicker than send a self-addressed stamp envelope in, those kinds of things where somebody who needs to know or is trying to make an informed decision about the choice of a doctor just for whatever bureaucratic or legitimate reasons can't get that information. And if we can, and if we should, then I think that's something for this committee to consider very seriously.
Thank you both very much. My plan is to ask Brenda Ross come in to testify on 3492 and then to ask Kathleen Haley again and Scott Gallant, who are going to testify on both of them, to testify on both of them together. So, Ms. Ross, would you join us, please? Introduce yourself to the record. You're welcome to stay, Representative Gillen.
I will.
You can stay right up there, I mean. Provide moral support. Mm-hmm. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Brenda Ross. Thank you, Chair Greenlick and representatives, for this opportunity to tell you what happened to me. In 1999, I went in to have LASIK eye surgery. Prior to going in to have the surgery, I called the Board of Medical Examiners to find out if my doctor had any complaints against him. I was told that he had none. After my surgery, I learned that he had three complaints lodged against him. I now know of four, and there probably are more. I don't know. Once I found out this information, I again called the board back, thinking maybe I had misspoken or I had misheard. And again, they told me my doctor had no complaints lodged against him. So I asked them, how can you tell me that this doctor has no complaints lodged against him when I have copies sitting in front of me? And they said, we don't investigate unless the complaint settles for over $100,000. Well, the problem is, out of these four people that I now know of who have lodged complaints, one of the people was a doctor lodging a complaint against another doctor. He didn't have a lawsuit. Another one of these complaints that was lodged was a man who went in to have an examination, and the examination was performed by one of his staff members who wasn't even licensed. And when he had the examination, the doctor that I used came into the room and only saw him for about 90 seconds. And in that time frame, told him he needed cataract surgery, told him he needed refractive surgery, and never examined him and left the room. This man went and got a second opinion, and when he got his second opinion, the prescription that was written out to him was different, and he was told he didn't need cataract surgery, and so he filed a complaint. He wasn't suing either. The other two people had lawsuits, and both of them were beat in a court of law. And so because there wasn't a $100,000 settlement, neither one of their complaints were heard. Had they been heard, I wouldn't be here today. After my surgery, when I called back to the board, I asked if I could file a complaint. The board recommended that I wait until my lawsuit was complete before I file a complaint, or they would interfere with my investigation. So in 2002, when my complaint or when my lawsuit became complete, I filed a complaint. In 2006, my doctor was suspended. He got 30 days suspension and 5 years probation. He got to work from 1999 until 2006 without anything on his radar. And I think that somewhere in there, he should have been caught before then. Many other people were injured from the time of my surgery up until a complaint or until an action was taken. I know that other people have filed complaints against him, yet only two complaints are showing up on the website right now. What this bill would do, it would make it so that if somebody called in to the Board of Medical Examiners, they could find out that a complaint does exist, and they could find out the date the complaint was filed. They could find out the nature of the complaint and then the status of the complaint, and it would shorten the time period that a investigator has to report back to the board. I believe that this bill would help immensely. Lawyers have this set up. There's the Bar Association. Contractors have this set up. There's the Better Business Bureau. And it works great for them, and it would work great for doctors. Doctors hold our lives in their hands, and they make life and death decisions every day about us, and we have a right to know. I feel as a citizen, I have a right to make a complaint and to be heard. And I feel as a citizen, I have a right to hear other people's complaints and make my own decision. And that's what this bill would do. And I'm asking you all, please vote yes to 3492.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahler.
Thank you. Normally when there's a complaint, there's damage. And was there damage to your eyes as a result of this procedure? And if so, can you explain that?
My eye, when they did the surgery, they cut too deep into my eye and penetrated the anterior chamber and fluid leaked out. It left me needing a cornea transplant. I'm a chicken liver right now. They aborted the surgery on me while I was on the table, and it was probably the most traumatic thing I ever went through. And so I'm terrified to go through another surgery. I will hang on just as long as I can. Right now, I wear a huge contact lens. It's a hard lens. It goes clear out into the white part of my eye. I have to use a plunger to remove it. It has a vent hole drilled in it. If I can't wear that lens, then I have to wear a piggyback system, and that's where I wear two contact lenses in my eye at once, one being a soft lens with a hard lens on top of it. When I go to glasses, I lose the function of this eye. Can I show pictures?
Ask the chair.
Thank you. I have a picture of how I see today, even with correction. And I see things. I can see a picture, but it's a distorted picture. And there's a woman standing in front of a window. When I have to deal with light and dark situations, going to the movies is almost impossible for me, doing things like that where there's light and dark together. So I do. I struggle every single day. I don't have functional vision with glasses. So I, on days when I have to be up very late, it's excruciating to keep my contact in as long as I do. But I struggle through it.
So. Just a follow up to that. When you, I'm not an optometrist or an ophthalmologist, but when you have a hard contact lens and it requires a hole in that.
It's but to allow fluid in and out.
Exactly. I was going to say, that you don't drill a hole without having something draining. So.
And you did have a lawsuit against?
I did, and I settled out of court and was gagged. But my case was heinous enough that the board chose to look into it, and I thank them for doing that.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming and testifying.
Thank you.
Okay, we really appreciate it. Thank you, Representative Gillian, for helping the process along.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Can we call Kathleen Haley and Scott Gallant? If you'd rather do one at a time, we can do it that way, or we can do both and whatever. Can you do one at a time? Okay, let's do 2015 first. Unless you want to do it the other way. Both of them are still open.
Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Haley. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners, and I'm here to testify on House Bill 2015. The board does currently publish and release an annual report for each calendar year that details statistics regarding board licensees, also investigations and their outcomes, so the board does not believe it would be an undue burden for us to report the malpractice annual reports as called for in the bill. The board currently sends its reports to the governor, members of the legislature, professional organizations, and other interested citizens. And so we are neutral as to this bill, and we do not believe that there is any fiscal impact attached to it. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll sort of continue the line of questioning that I began with Representative Barnhart, which related to how these complaints proceed. I go first to the doctor. He explained who then is required under contract to disclose it to the malpractice insurer, which is then required by statute to disclose the claim to the board. What does the board do at that point, and at what point does the board get involved, report, et cetera?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, the board tracks that. If the allegations are such that the board would need to immediately open an investigation, we can do that. Otherwise, we track it until it's closed, and then we review that at the time it's closed to see both the amount of the award, what the findings were. That information is then put on the board's website once the case is closed. It's available to the public.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. What I think you mentioned, the initial determination is whether something needs to be done in the first instance, immediately. What's your decision point there?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, I'm just going to take something very egregious and give you an example. Let's say that the allegation is that the physician was intoxicated in the operating room. That's something that we would not wait until the case was closed. We'd want to get right on that type of a case.
Follow up?
Please.
Are there rules by which you make that determination, or is this a sort of subjective determination on the part of the board?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Canna, these cases are reviewed by our medical director, our chief investigator, our assistant attorney general, and in some cases myself. So if there was any question, it would be run through all those different channels to see about whether or not to open it. The case, the example I gave you was egregious. There wouldn't be any question.
And follow up again?
Just keep going.
Would, in that egregious case, say, where you do decide upon a notification from the malpractice insurer that there's potentially an egregious example of malpractice here, would you, it sounds like you would look into it, conduct an examination. At what point does information become public? I think that's really the crux of all of this.
Right. Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, before the advent of the website, it was available in hard copy. I've been with the board for 13 years, and it's always been available in hard copy. Once the case is closed, once it's adjudicated.
Is a complaint ever available publicly before a case is closed?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, the malpractice cases, they're not, no.
Does the board ever sanction a doctor before adjudication? And you mentioned that egregious example where you take interest immediately, mm-hmm. but you wouldn't take any steps against the sanctions against the doctor before the closure of the case, the public notification.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, yes, we could. The board could emergently suspend that physician. That would be public information.
That would be public.
Immediately.
Even though the case isn't closed.
That's right, because the allegations would have been separately investigated by the board.
Okay.
Yeah, different standard.
What about if the case is closed out of court and gag order is in? What do you do with those cases?
Chair Greenlick, we have to know about them in order to be able to investigate them. We do
know something happened. I mean, you know there was a case filed, right? I mean, you're told when the proceeding begins.
True.
So you now know there's an open case. Sometimes that case gets closed. You always just keep it open?
Chair Greenlick, we keep it open until we've been notified that it's closed.
Is there a requirement to notify you when it's settled out of court?
By the insurance companies, yes.
There is a requirement that
yes.
they notify you.
Yes.
And then you've been notified it's been settled out of court. How do you handle that?
Chair Greenlick, just like all the other cases, we would investigate depending on the allegations and the amount of the award.
But is that public information at that point?
Once it's closed,
that
yes.
That there's been a settlement?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. I can ask just a few questions that continue this because I'm not seeing the relationship between the board, which has as its mission to assure the safety of the state, and the fact that there may be a malpractice claim, because malpractice is a separate issue than competency to practice. And so why would your work have anything to do with whether a claim is litigated, settled, withdrawn, gagged, or anything else, since that is a different arena, a different jurisdiction, a different level of burden, you know, burden of proof and that kind of thing. So why is there a connection between what you do and what might happen or might not happen in a civil arena?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, I think that's an important question. Let's say we have one case pending open on a physician involving quality of care. And then we find that there is a malpractice case that comes in that is in the same arena, maybe the same surgical technique. That is something that tells us there's more than one problem out there. And the board's proof in order to take discipline is either gross negligence or repeated acts of negligence, whereas, as you said, in the malpractice arena, it's simple negligence. You're right. One case standing alone probably would not be sufficient in and of itself. However, if it's an extremely high award or there are multiple cases, we need to have them reviewed by a consultant to determine whether or not that physician is safe to practice.
Follow up. Again, I don't see what the relationship is. Supposing that a patient goes in and they have an eye problem,
mm-hmm.
okay, but the actual value of that is, you know, $10,000. Okay, not a huge amount of money, but to the person, it's a very real problem, and maybe there was intoxication at the time or something else like that.
Mm-hmm.
What does the value that might be determined in a civil action have to do with whether or not there was a violation of standard of care by the physician, which you'd have to evaluate in response to a complaint?
Well, they do an individual evaluation, an investigation of that.
Yes.
Yeah, but what I'm hearing is that no action is taken unless there's going to, unless there's adjudication or what. There's a lot of hinging based on the civil aspect. And supposing that the person says, I'm against litigation completely. I don't want to take any further action at all. But I just want you to know that this is a situation that took place. It seems to me like what you do should be separate from what may or may not take place in a civil arena, because that is a different jurisdiction.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, let me try to answer the question as I understand it. The fact of one civil lawsuit in and of itself, you're right, standing alone, certainly would not be grounds for the board unless it was gross negligence.
Okay, can I stop right? Why are we talking about civil lawsuits? What I'm talking about is, irrespective of civil lawsuits, you have the board. Your mission is to watch out for the well-being of the people, and you get a complaint by a citizen who says this took place. It either measures up to standard of care or not. Why is the answer even contain the word civil lawsuit?
Chair Greenlick, I thought we were talking about House Bill 2015, and that's what that's about.
Well, actually, since you can't start acting, asking this question, we shifted in the other side.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that you were talking about the other
I've kind of continued that, and I'd be happy to step back and only deal with this.
Deal with this bill first.
The kind of questions have shifted over into this other aspect.
So they are gathering, by law, they are gathering data on negligence, on malpractice, and this bill says, should they report it, and they say it's no problem to do.
Right.
Scott, do you have a problem with this?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. I've submitted written testimony. I want to make a couple of points, one in response from an earlier question, which I believe was, why is this statute even on the books? It was adopted quite some time ago. During the early 80s, in order to provide a mechanism for one entity, the information actually used to go somewhere else, and we supported this change, by the way, so that there would be an access point to be able to track liability suits. So that's why it's on the books. Goes back a long time. My issue with this bill is that it doesn't really provide a broad policy context for liability across the board, whether it happens to be healthcare or medical personnel, professionals, or others. The last time the legislature requested an actual detailed review of the liability market in Oregon and status, I believe, was after the 2001 session as a part of a rural liability subsidy program, which set up a independent panel to look into liability premiums, et cetera, et cetera. That study, as I recall, cost approximately $100,000 or so dollars to conduct, and I believe it's still available at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Secondarily, the Medical Association also has done some analyses, in fact, using the same actuary that the malpractice panel of 01 used to do an analysis of the transaction costs associated with professional liability, which we had presented to members of the legislature last session as well. And if you would like, I can always submit another copy to you if you really want entertaining reading, but you probably don't. One of the things about, and I say this in my written testimony on the other bill, and we'll talk about, and I'd like to spend a little time on that testimony when you get to it, but is that most people would observe that Representative Richardson is absolutely right. There is not a connection. There are a couple of non-connections other than malpractice claims, settlements, or otherwise being a tool for the Board of Medical Examiners, which we support, is that it is not necessarily an indicator of whether or not a physician is competent to practice medicine. Unfortunately, many awards are not really on the basis, you have an award, it's supposed to be on the basis of the community standard of care of the physician, et cetera, are really more an indicator of the severity of the injury. Rightfully or wrongfully, that's what happens. And in my testimony on this bill, I just tried to give you an illustration in just one area, happens to be OBs. In a 06 survey, 89% of all OBs in the survey, and it's a huge survey nationwide, have had a claim filed against them in their career. Most of them are dropped, and et cetera, et cetera. So for the purposes of the board, one, it's a tool. I think it's an important tool. But as a matter of policy for just one area of interest, I think it fails on a broader policy basis because there are other areas that I'm sure are of just as important, as much importance to the legislature than merely professional liability.
We're not hearing about the professional liability crisis in massage therapy, say, for example. I mean, we're hearing about the crisis. I understood what Representative Barnett was talking about. It was because there's a crisis that we're all worried about, as you are, and medical liability, some more information might be useful. I think that's why medicine and not...
Well, Mr. Chairman, and my other point, and this is significant, merely saying X number of cases have been filed, X number have been dropped, and X number have been adjudicated don't really provide the legislature with a substantive report on the status of medical professional negligence. I don't mean to be obstreperous, but I don't think it really does. And any legitimate, serious evaluation of liability, whether it's the 01 or 02 work or otherwise, is not something that is done well on the cheap.
Are there any other questions? Let's close the hearing on 2015, and let's go on with your testimony on 3492.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Haley. I'm the director of the Board of Medical Examiners, and the board does oppose House Bill 3492. While it takes its charge very seriously to protect the public and also the need for transparency in its dealings, it doesn't believe that this bill gets us there. The board has been rated in the top 15 for its website nationally in terms of the type and quality of information that is available to the public. Right now you can get the full text of the board's public orders, information on closed malpractice cases, and licensing information about the board's 15,000 licensees. For those persons who do not have internet access, we do have a complaint resource officer and a toll-free telephone assistance. If you call the board's office and ask about actions involving a physician, if you do not have a website, the complaint resource officer will walk you through that publicly available information. The board believes that there are some balancing tests involved in this public policy decision, and that is the right to privacy, the board's ability to undertake complete and fair investigation, and the public's right to know. Some of the best sources we have for complaints that result in discipline are other healthcare professionals and pharmacies. But if the existence of complaints were available publicly, then the board staff believe it would lose some of the best sources of information available. All other healthcare professional regulatory boards are governed by the same statute and all treat complaint release the same. Until an investigation is complete and the board issues a statement of charges, which is called, unfortunately, a complaint and notice because it starts to blur those words again. But once the board votes to go to discipline and issues that statement of charges, that document is public. And that details the allegations against that physician. One of the other areas of concern for the board are the small rural areas in which, in particular in sexual misconduct areas, if a complaint is brought against a physician, it's very easy to identify the complainant. And one of the board's concerns is that there be retaliation or harassment against those complainants. I recently did a survey of other states to find out what was going on nationally. 27 boards responded to that survey. And only two, Arkansas and Massachusetts, make those complaints available to the public. One of the other concerns is in terms of attracting physicians to the state, this bill would not particularly assist if we were going to say that we will be one of the three states in the union that would open complaints to the public. The board does recognize the public's need to know about health care concerns and about their providers. And to that end, we provide a lot of very valid, verified information. The board believes that once an investigation is complete and has been found that there is a statement of charges issues, that should be made public. I've attached for your review an article that I wrote last year for the board's newsletter about transparency, as well as a couple of copies of the public documents that are available regarding physicians. And the matter of Dr. Lee I included because there is that case where there's an interim stipulated order. It's not a final document, but it is a final order of the board, so that is available to the public. The other problem the board has with House Bill 3492 is it requires investigators to report to the board no later than 90 days after the complaint is brought forward. And during the past 5 years, it does take us considerably longer than that to complete investigations. This proposed reporting requirement would require that we close cases where they are not complete. There are many factors that go into an investigation and the time involved in completing them. We need to get a response from the physician. We need to have a consultant review the records. And in some cases, there are voluminous patient records. Well, the board believes that the intent is to enhance consumer information protection. The board is concerned that the result of its passage would actually inhibit the board's ability to do its business and protect the public. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions? Yeah, do you have a question?
I do, but go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay. So I guess I'm from the testimony, I'm not seeing if you can explain to me how the lady that testified before makes a phone call and gets a response, no. And that apparently is the end of it. And I don't know the timing. And I don't know the timing of those issues. But it seems to me from a consumer standpoint that even the acknowledgement that there is a complaint filed may, you know, I don't know how does the bar handle it. I understand one complaint is not necessarily an issue, but if you've got three or four or five, then maybe someone's going to start questioning that. I'm kind of just trying to figure out, trying to make point, you know, connect some dots here as to why she would get a response now, and that would be the end of the conversation.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer, in terms of, and I'm sorry to kind of mix both these things we're talking about, and going back and looking, there was one lawsuit that had been adjudicated in the matter of the physician that Ms. Ross testified about, where there was a $40,000 attorney fee, but there was no award against the physician at that time. So if, assuming that case had closed then, she would have been told about that malpractice case. She would not have been told if there were other complaints. If someone was to call today about that physician, they would get the malpractice information, including hers. They would also get the disciplinary action, which included suspension, reprimand, maximum fine, 5 years probation, and all the details of that as well.
One thing I'm not clear about are sealed cases and how that is handled. Gag orders.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Moore, if we know about it, then we can release that information. If we don't know about it, then we can't.
I don't understand that. I mean, you said that before, right? Either somebody's obligated to tell you that it's been settled or it's not.
Chair Greenlick, the insurance companies are obligated to tell us that.
Okay, so it's settled out of court. You don't know what happened. What do you do with that?
If it's settled out of court and we are told one way or the other if there's no award or if there is a final award.
And if there's a final award, then
we report
you will release that to the public.
That's correct.
Regardless of the amount? I assume it's regardless of the amount.
That's right.
And if there's no award, settle out of court and no award, which means it's dropped, obviously, I assume.
Chair Greenlick, we would also tell them that. There had been a lawsuit. There was no, it was closed with no finding. No award.
Now you can.
I'd like to renew my question. And that is that as this discussion goes on, there's this constant.
We do want to make sure we have time for
be very quick.
One more bill.
There seems to be an inherent relationship between what the board is doing and whether or not there's civil litigation going on. And yet the real issue is whether or not the complaint by a patient shows that there has been a standard of care that is dangerous for the public, and there needs to be some action taken. And so what does the board do to help assure that the patients are protected, and that anyone, a doctor who is not competent or has drug problems or whatever, is dealt with completely separate from anything that may or may not take place in a civil action?
Okay. Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson, once the board receives a complaint, let's say it involves a care issue, a surgical care issue, and I think I included an example. There were two examples I provided for you with my testimony, and the second one is an example of surgical care issues. In that case, the board would have our medical director review the patient records in that case. That case would then go to a 5-member panel of the board, 4 physicians and 1 public member who review that case. They will determine, there, it looks like there's a problem here, we need to get a consultant. The consultant will review that chart and maybe 5 other additional charts to see if there is a pattern of a problem here with that physician. That physician then comes into an investigative committee meeting with the board and answers questions while the consultant in that specialty is present. So a surgeon would be present in addition to the board members who are physicians, in addition to the medical director. And that physician is then queried about that case as well as the other cases to determine whether there's a violation of law. If there is, if the board has that index that meets the legal standard.
Violation of law?
Of the Medical Practices Act. The board's statute, the Medical Practice Act.
That's not determined just by the lawsuit. That has to be determined some other way. Right?
This is determined by the board's review together with a consultant. And then that matter is referred from the 5 members of the investigative committee to the full board, who then vote to issue a complaint notice. And that becomes public at that point. The investigation is complete. The board believes there's been a violation of the standard of care. The board believes that there needs to either be some type of remediation and or punishment, for lack of a better word.
Still, there's, and I understand where you're going with it. That this is the way it's been, and this is the way that it's done, and that way, if it is egregious, there's action taken. If it doesn't meet that threshold or whatever the threshold is, then there's no disclosure to the public that there was ever even a complaint.
That's true.
Okay.
Mr. Gallant.
Can you briefly enlighten us on the OMA's views on this issue?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Scott Gallant. I don't know if I can meet your requirement. I'll try to.
We have another bill.
Yes, sir.
I
understand.
From a long way, so.
I'm inhibited by speaking slowly. Yes, I know. I'll try to speed it up. Thank you, sir. There are 27 statutory bases for a violation of the Medical Practice Act, which the board is obligated uses to make a determination of whether or not a physician or others who are under its jurisdiction have violated the Licensure Practice Act. All right. 90% of the complaints that are filed, which, by the way, are anonymous complaints, are found not to be legitimate. And it's very important. I agree with Representative Richardson. There, you need to make a distinction between the use of the tool of malpractice issues versus the responsibility of the board to enforce the Practice Act as it's outlined in statute. I mentioned a few of the areas that physicians have been disciplined on the front page of my testimony. And I also make a distinction again, and I think this is important, because most people, again, would agree that merely losing or having a payment in a malpractice suit is not necessarily an indicator of one's competence, which is why it's important for the board to do its own independent review, regardless of what the impetus is. A number of years ago, the process for when it is disclosed that there is a complaint was changed to apply to all healthcare professionals. And in fact, that information is more readily available today than it was before these changes. The balance that we supported, and we want the board to be an aggressive enforcer of its statute, we may have our spats, which we do on occasion, on their approach to things. But the balance is that you have anonymous complaints that may or may not be legitimate. And I can assure you there are a variety of different types of patients that one might see over the course of one's daily practice. There is a balance between having an anonymous complaint filed, the professional reputation of the physician, and getting to a point where you know that we're not, that there is not either some vendetta or there is some campaign, or that this might be used as a tool for the purpose of litigation down the road. All of those things of serious concern, as it is to make sure that when legitimate complaints are filed with the Board of Medical Examiners, that they are dealt with quickly and efficiently as we can. And we support that. But to merely open up any complaint that is filed prior to knowing whether it has some basis for actual investigation, I think is exceedingly inappropriate. in this instance, and we would not and cannot support that approach. I'll stop at that. Other than that's another issue. I'll stop at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gell. Are there any questions, Mr. Gell?
Mr. Chair,
and thank you for standing up here.
Thank you. This may go back to the board as well. I guess I want to just refer to a couple of points in Brenda Ross's testimony and try to have a slightly better understanding of what might have taken place. She reports that she called the Board of Medical Examiners after finding out through the discovery process that there were some complaints and was told that you only investigate complaints that have an award of over $100,000. This relates to the triggering that the malpractice award can have. Is that the case, that there's a $100,000 point at which you begin to...
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, I think at that time that's what was happening, yes.
If those complainants, if those...
Well, I just want to clarify what I said earlier also is true, that if the allegation is such that it needs to take immediate action, then the board also has that option.
If those complainants, instead of, or in addition to, filing civil action against the doctor, had come to the board in this sort of separate process, not the civil process, but said, I have a problem with the doctor, something went wrong, would you have launched an investigation?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, yes, and we did.
I'm finding this so confusing. So you did launch an investigation, and presumably because you didn't report complaints against the doctor, that investigation was inconclusive. Didn't find...
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, in the physician involving Ms. Ross's surgery has been disciplined. He's...
Right, but if I could, he had not been disciplined at the point at which she was calling, and their complaints had been launched against him, civil action had been taken against him, awards of over $100,000 had not been gathered, and you perhaps had begun an investigation but had not made any conclusions.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, he had not been disciplined prior to that time. Our records show that there was one other lawsuit in which there was a $40,000 attorney fee, and that was what we had in terms of the malpractice at that time.
Okay. I think that the response that she got on the phone, that we only investigate complaints that have an award over $100,000, is a little misleading in the sense that, or confusing in the sense that perhaps there were investigations as a result of a complaint to the board ongoing at the time. That's separate from the question whether that should be reported to the public or not, but I'm beginning to have a better understanding at least of what was happening there. She also reports that most lawsuits settle with a confidentiality clause that precludes the patient from divulging the amount of settlement in the lawsuit, which creates this sort of catch-22. What's your response to that?
Well, Chair Greenlick, we regularly get the reports from the insurance companies, and that's the information that we act on and that we make available to the public.
And do those insurance companies report, even in a case that has a confidentiality clause, do they report the amount of the damages?
I'm not aware that they're withholding information from us. We were aware in the last year or so that we weren't getting full malpractice reports from all entities, and we brought a bill this session to try to address that.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm going to close this hearing. We have some folks that have come from a long way. I do want to say, I think we need to figure out a way to get more information to the public in this arena in a way that doesn't do what Mr. Gallant's worrying about, that really doesn't inappropriately injure physicians. But somewhere we need... nor screw up your ability to investigate what you need to investigate. But I really do think we need to find a way that gets more information. I don't know whether we have time left in this
in this session or whether we can find some way to talk about how to move that ball down the field a little bit. But I think many of us are really uncomfortable with the level of information patients get who call in good faith and are looking for information and aren't necessarily getting it. Representative Gillen, you have a closing statement you want to make on this?
I merely wanted to ask, knowing that your time is short, that it's come to my attention there is another individual who wished to testify who has arrived late, and I just wanted to know if that would be permissible.
For 2 minutes, perhaps? Would
2 minutes.
Work? Haley and Mr. Gillen, thank you very much.
Just one other balance, too. You want to make sure that you still encourage anonymous complaints and how you balance all of those pieces is exceedingly complex.
It is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
If I may make a comment, I mean, this is an argument for tort reform in general, and that the reason people game the system like they do today is because the reward is so high, and we don't see gaming the system against teachers because, trust me, there's no reward. And we may see it against lawyers, but that's not really the game. But the game today is in the practice of medicine, and the rewards are so high for abuse of the system that I think it's very reasonable that the OMA, as that representative, I mean, is extremely hesitant to go in that direction.
Yeah, I think we have to act very cautiously. Would you introduce yourself, please, and please be brief.
I'll try. My name is Kevin Wall, and I filed a lawsuit back in 1995 against the same doctor that Brenda Ross did also, and that complaint wasn't shown on the board at the board when I called back to ask them if they had received any complaints or anything against this doctor. And in 1995, he came to Oregon under a temporary license, and I was undergoing an RK surgery, and I went to find out about his history, and I found nothing out about his history. And I had a bad situation with him. It basically had nothing to do with the actual surgery itself. He didn't perform the surgery correctly and everything, but it wasn't enough that I could pay enough attorneys and enough doctors to represent me to push this forward. It takes a tremendous amount of money in a medical lawsuit. But my main concern was the misrepresentation of the surgery itself, and this doctor was particularly selling these laser and RK surgeries and other surgeries without full consent of the patient on whether they really needed to undergo the surgery or not. And these are things that are not going to end up at the board as so much as a medical negligence. My lawsuit appeared in the Statesman Journal under those tiny little print and, unsettled. And I got probably 5 phone calls immediately from other patients in the area, from Woodburn to Malala to other places that had this same. They called me to find out what my complaint was about because it was only just a one-sentence complaint in the thing saying I was suing him for negligence. And they proceeded to tell me their complaint against this doctor, too, about his misrepresentation and his sloppiness and everything else, basically rushing people through and making money. And so these complaints, I know, I asked them to write this to the board. If they did, I have copies of these complaints also, showing the integrity of this individual. And that's, I think, a big thing that a person would look at, whether they're going under a surgery, to see. And none of these complaints were ever exposed. And I called back up to 2 and 3 years later, just asked them if they had any complaints, and I still received the answer of no, there's no complaints against this doctor. So since there was no lawsuits and no resolution on such lawsuits, these complaints are basically sealed. And I was hoping maybe they could find some better way that as a consumer I can find out more information. When I went to other doctors in the area to try to get my problems resolved, they knew a tremendous amount of information about this doctor that was new to the area, and other people like me had gone to them trying to resolve their eye problems. And basically, these doctors now do not want to get involved, and we're sending everybody to Portland, KCI Institute, and everything else. So anyway, that is basically how I came to...
Thank you very much. I think we do have information that the doctor has been disciplined, and ultimately that came out a long way downstream.
Yeah, 11 years.
Thank you very much.
Surgery in the process, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on 3492. I do need to announce that we are going to carry over House Bill 3502 and schedule it for the subcommittee meeting on Monday, and now open a public hearing on 3342. And I'd like to call, if first I'd like our administrator to explain it, but I'd like to call Don Bruland, who requested this. We actually heard testimony from Mr. Bruland and in our televised hearing, but we'll hear again. And
thank you, Chair.
Administrator?
Briefly, this is a fairly simple bill. It does require the Department of Human Services to establish by rule a program to make grants of not more than $100,000 per county per calendar year for the purpose of administering a public guardianship or conservator program, and also requires counties that wish to qualify to provide at least 25% of the amount received by the department. This does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Chair Greenlit, members of the committee, I'll try and make my testimony briefer than what you'll receive in the written deal, because there are other people who also wish to speak to this bill. My name is Don Bruland, and I'm Director of Senior and Disability Services for the Rogue Valley Council of Governments, serving Jackson and Josephine counties. I'm here today to discuss the need for public guardianship programs, their importance both in protecting highly vulnerable seniors and people with disabilities, and the impact that they the lack of these programs have on health care costs. Oregon law requires an act of the court to place an individual under the care of a guardian or conservator. It is my philosophy and that of my agency to support the right of an individual to retain their independence even when they make decisions which may adversely impact their health and safety. Even when a person has a significant diminished capacity to make decisions, there are less intrusive means of providing assistance, either on an informal or formal basis. Moreover, in the majority of cases where there is a need for the establishment of either a conservator or guardian, there is a family member or a friend who is willing, able, and appropriate to perform this function. There are, however, a limited number of situations where there is no family member or friend who is willing, able, or appropriate to perform these services for individuals at risk. Unfortunately, in some of these situations, it is from the family members or so-called friends that the individual must be protected. In these cases, a public guardian program is not only appropriate but essential if a person is to be protected and public resources are not to be wasted. I would like to briefly elaborate on how the lack of public guardians can not only put a person into jeopardy but waste public health care resources. Two recent examples of the very public costs of the lack of available guardianship I'd like to now cite. The first involves a senior who was admitted to a local hospital with an intracerebral hemorrhage. Prior to the hemorrhage, he had been receiving care in an adult foster home as a result of previous head trauma and organic brain syndrome. As a result of the hemorrhage, he was admitted to the hospital where he was non-responsive, bedridden, incontinent, and required a feeding tube. Though his condition was stabilized in a few days, he remained in the hospital for over 6 weeks. Because he did not have a guardian or any known relatives, he remained in the hospital while staff searched for a temporary guardian. Nursing homes refused to take him without a guardian, and eventually a temporary guardianship was established and he was appropriately placed. Though hospitals have procedures to address these situations, they take time, and meanwhile the individual is using up resources for which the hospital is unlikely to be reimbursed, or at least not fully reimbursed. Since the individuals that we are talking about are frequent flyers to hospitals, this can become a very costly proposition. In the previous mentioned case, the estimated public cost of the lack of a guardian ran well over $100,000 for the hospital, even after the state paid its part of that care. This is many times the cost of what it would be to have that person maintained with a public guardian. Another case which recently came to my attention is the case of John, a 30-year-old man who is developmentally disabled. He lived until recently with his mother, who drank, used drugs, and moved frequently. She often left John without food and was physically violent with him, which she justified saying that she loved him and had never actually been convicted of violence towards him. She was not willing to place John in a DD home, group home, because she needed his income to pay her rent. The DD case management system made numerous efforts to offer training and support to her. Following a particularly violent episode, the public guardian applied for guardianship of John at the request of abuse investigators. The mother objected to the guardianship. After a lengthy and costly court process, the court found that there was no family member suitable to serve as a guardian, and the public guardian's office was appointed as a guardian. John has since been placed in a group home and in a work site, where he is very excited about having a job and a little spending money. Currently, there are only two counties in Oregon that have public guardian programs, Multnomah and Jackson. Discussions with other areas of the state indicate that though there is a need for a public guardianship program, none has been established because of the lack of stable funding available to maintain a program. I've talked with Attorney General Hardy Myers about this, and he has expressed his support of the need to establish and fund a grant program which will encourage and enable local areas to create and maintain public guardianship programs. To address this problem, I've worked with Representative Richardson to draft House Bill 3342, which would establish a state-funded grant program at $2 million per biennium. This grant program would award up to $100,000 per year to a county or multi-county organization to establish and maintain local public guardianship programs. Local areas would match any state funds with a 25% match from other cash or in-kind resources to obtain the funds. It is anticipated that in most areas, the state funds would serve as a core funding, and areas would raise additional local resources beyond the 25% match. I won't elaborate on it, but we'll be happy to answer any questions, and I want to thank you for your time and attention to this critical issue.
Thank you very much for driving up. Any questions?
Well, I have one, but I don't know if it's appropriate.
I knew it appropriate.
Okay. Well, what happened to this young man's or this person's mother?
I don't know. This was a case that was given to me out of Multnomah County, and thus it's not in my area, and I don't know the details. But I
thrown out of her home, and she's living in the street.
Well, that's what I was wondering. not that it's
no.
I
understand.
Utilize her son's benefits, but
I understand the issue.
I mean, in a good situation, it's perfectly appropriate. In that case, she's providing the home, and it makes a lot of sense.
With stability, yeah.
It's when it goes bad that it's
a
problem.
And once again, this is the type of thing, in most cases, when there is a person who is incapacitated, our hope and goal, I think, throughout the state is to first work with the family to help maintain them and assist the family. Same thing in terms of when there's a need for a guardianship or something. When we establish public guardianship programs, we don't take on everybody who probably needs a public guardian. But you pick those really difficult situations where there is one no alternative and where the consequences are very dramatic and costly both to the individual and, quite frankly, to the state.
Mr. Brown, thank you very much for your testimony.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yep. Sure.
Mr. Whelan, thank you, Don, for bringing this forward. And something has come up that I just wanted to see your opinion on, and that is if there is a county that has access to a nonprofit organization or another organization that isn't part of the county's office, do you see a problem with the county contracting with an organization to serve in this capacity, if that's what they
do? No. In fact, one of the things I purposely did not get into a great amount of detail for a couple reasons. One, because I did not want to do a lot of tinkering with the basic statute, which provides for guardianship and public guardianship. And second, because I think that there needs to be some flexibility in looking at how places establish this. I do think that there will need to be a time for us to work at the state level and to determine what criteria they should be, but it clearly, I don't think that it's in many cases the best or situation to put it under a county. And in fact, I would not put it under my organization because there would be a potential conflict of interest, since we provide benefits to the person also, and there should be could be a real question as whether we were managing it for their benefit or for our benefit as an organization. So I think that separation is a critical piece.
Thank you very much. Here's my plan. I'd like to call Morgan Brody now and Jeff Brendan. I can get, and then the next group I'd like to call Claudia Koch, who's come from a long way, Charles Wright, and Ingleby. That's great. We'll get that for the next.
Please, if you'd introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Morgan Brody. I'm an Adult Protective Service Program Coordinator at Seniors and People with Disabilities for the Department of Human Services. In the interest of your time, we have submitted written testimony. I know that Mr. Ruland has raised many of the basic pieces of information for your consideration. What we would like to point out as the department are just a few things. This bill would ask us to set up a fund of up to $100,000 a year in grants per county, and also to adopt rules for the application and grant approval criteria for those funds, which we're very interested in doing. Currently, the department in our section does have a program to handle requests for funds to petition for guardianships and conservatorships. In 2006, we had 217 requests for those petitions, and using a pretty high standard of criteria, we approved only 56% of the requests for conservatorships and 13% of the requests for guardianships. I think for us what makes this a little problematic is that we have an ethical dilemma of two goods, which is always a little more difficult than a good and a bad. We're trying to balance autonomy versus safety. We're trying to balance people's civil rights versus the kinds of public costs that Mr. Brulin talked about. So it's important to us, as to the other people who are interested in this bill, that any program looking at establishing guardianships and conservatorships rule out the existence of other less restrictive alternatives that might be of benefit to the person, that there is clear evidence of the incapacity of the person to take care of themselves or their functional impairment to do so, that there is an imminent threat to their health, safety, or welfare, and that they will benefit from the establishment of a guardianship or conservatorship. So our interest in looking at setting standards for this program is that we be able to meet with our colleagues and develop criteria so that a decentralized program of county public guardians would have consistent standards, consistent monitoring for outcomes for the people under whose jurisdiction the program would apply and to whom it would apply, that really this establishment of a guardianship would be a last resort alternative. I know that there has been research, particularly in Lane County, in looking at the pros and cons and looking at diversion programs such as money management, and we certainly would be in support of that. In summary, the department's position is the funds required to institute this bill are not in the governor's recommended budget, so of course that puts us in the position of not being able to wholeheartedly support the bill at this time. However, we would be very interested in establishing and working with our colleagues in a work group to establish how this program should work, to establish with a surety that the safeguards are there for the citizens of the state and that it can be responsibly administered. So thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. This bill certainly does have a subsequent referral of Ways and Means. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Brandon. I'm on the Governor's Commission for Senior Services. I'm also retired after acting for the past 25 years as Deputy Public Guardian and Conservator of Multnomah County. I'm a certified Guardian Conservator, past president of the Guardian Conservator Association, so I've got a lot of experience. I have written testimony, and I'm not going to look at it. It's in my head. I want to say real briefly some things, and you know, I know it's a long day for you guys.
Everybody else has a chance.
The statute for public guardian conservator was passed by the legislature in 1971, and Multnomah County adopted it in 1973. I started to work there in 1978. And I worked there for the next 25 years. It's a going, thriving program. It has a staff of 10 or 11 people now. It's been going for 35 years. But it's, along with Jackson, which is much more recent, it is the only county that has done this. And you know, again, for the last 35 years. And what the proponents are saying is the other counties desperately want to get on board, but they can't get it over the hump of the county commission. For instance, if you hear from Lane, I don't know if the Lane County person here today, but they're on the verge, and we need a bump from the state to get this over the hump and have more counties have public guardian conservator offices. And also like to say that there are states such as Arizona, California, Illinois, Florida, Alaska, Kansas that have full public guardian programs for the state and the county. So it, in California and Arizona, it's operated for decades. It's a real part of the system in those states. Okay, so to get to the point, in my testimony, I think I can sum it all up with a paradigm of a inverted pyramid, a triangle. Okay, so that's what I want you to envision. And after, again, those 25 years of working in the trenches in Multnomah County, here's what it's like. It's like at the top of this inverted pyramid is a huge segment of the population, what I call the silent underclass, that are unable to care for themselves or their property and do not have a substituted legal representative to do that. These are people in nursing homes. These are people in the community that have dementia, brain damage, mental illness, developmental disability. So what happens in this inverted pyramid in the system is everybody gets worked. And Morgan here knows all about Adult Protective Services, which is a very big program in the state of Oregon to take these protective service cases and these elder abuse reports and work them down this funnel and try to find a remedy. Well, at the bottom of this funnel is the last resort. Like in Multnomah County, it's down here, it's the public guardian office. It's that's what people, they call us up and say, you're the last resort. Will you take this case, please? Because in the middle are attorneys, private guardians, and conservators. They've picked out cases. And so finally, when you get down to us, it's either the public guardian or it's mental commitment, you know, involuntary commitment. Those are the two legal ways to substitute judgment for a person, you know, incapacitated person. So I guess in conclusion, I would like to say that the public guardian in Multnomah County is an integral part of the system, and it needs to be an integral part of the system in Washington County, Clackamas County, Lane County, and a whole bunch of other, Jackson County, a whole bunch of other counties, and it's just been overlooked for 35 years, and thanks to Don Bruin for getting this bill in and giving us a jump start, hopefully. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
And we have, we actually have four people, so if we can just get them up in some order. Claudia Koch has come from more than 100 miles, so I want her to be first. And then we have left Charles Wright. Is it Marie?
Marcy.
I'm sorry?
Marcy.
That sounds right, yeah. Marcy Ingold.
Uh-huh.
Come on. And Timothy Marble. So you probably need to have one sitting behind there.
No, sit back here.
And let's begin with Claudia Koch.
I'm taking somebody soon.
Hello. Thank you for chair and subcommittee for letting me testify today. I came from Forest Grove, part of Washington County. I work for Forest Grove Senior Center, a private 501c3.
Sorry, did you introduce your name?
Claudia Koch.
Thank you very
Sorry, maybe I missed that part. Thank you.
I'm not sure.
I think after I've heard what everyone else has had to say today, I'd like to just make it very brief by saying we are guardian and conservator for about a dozen clients in Washington County, and we receive referrals and every month, and we have to decline 2 to 4 referrals a month. So if you do the math, that's 25 to 50 people per year that we can't serve. And like Jeff had mentioned earlier, these are the people that have already been through the system. The APS, excuse me, Adult Protective Services, and other agencies have already looked for other alternatives, and they come to us because we have a sliding fee scale, and we try to take those clients that can't afford to pay, although to keep our program alive, we have to balance that. So I see the need. We were able to have partial funding from Washington County Older American Act money when we started in 2004. That money was designated for guardian, conservator, or money management, that other type of program, the least intrusive program that was mentioned. That was a $90,000 contract in 2004. It's now a $10,000 contract for only money management services. It no longer financially supports guardian and conservative services. So we do what we can, but we certainly see the need for a public guardian. And we wouldn't directly benefit from that. Only our county and those in our county would benefit from that. And I'd like to open it to questions, but I can keep it that brief.
That's okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Want me to go next?
Sure.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Marcy Ingledew. I'm the Executive Director for the ARC of Oregon, and I'm here in support of House Bill 3342, and I will try to keep my comments just as brief since a lot of testimony prior to myself has covered a lot of what I would say, and I've provided written testimony. The ARC of Oregon is a nonprofit statewide organization that's been in Oregon for over 50 years. We were started by parents, and particularly parents of individuals with developmental disabilities wondering what's going to happen to their sons and daughters someday when they're gone. And so in 1978, we formed what we call our Guardianship Advocacy and Planning Services Program. We refer to that as our GAPS program. We initially funded that program with foundation grants, and we offer guardianship, health care representation, and advocacy. Today we have over 100 individuals in Oregon with numerous staff located in 15 counties throughout Oregon. Based on the GAPS program and our experience in this field of guardianship, the ARC of Oregon supports this House Bill 3342 as important legislation that includes citizens in Oregon for seniors, individuals with developmental disabilities, and individuals with mental health issues. As the previous lady testified. I'm sorry, I forget your name. We have the same issue with referrals to our program. We probably receive at least probably 10 referrals per month, and we're only, based on our funding, usually take 3 to 4 individuals a year based on those referrals. So we're continually struggling. Although we currently have a small contract with the state that only provides services for 27 individuals, so the balance of our clients are currently on a pro bono basis for us, even though we have a fee schedule. We don't usually end up, because the individuals we get have nothing or have no family, so we end up serving them on a pro bono basis. So the other thing that I really would like to point out and reiterate was the importance that guardianship is a very complex and important issue, and we take that very seriously, and we would look to every other alternative before we would want to suggest that someone has a guardian. There's lots about with our healthcare rep service and our advocate program, we really look to that. I do want to give one brief example of the things that we see on an ongoing basis, just so you have an idea of what we're dealing with. Just a few months ago, we had a referral for someone that it was a 46-year-old woman with Down syndrome. She had been living with two siblings who also had significant mental and physical illness issues. The family had not received any outside support services. When this woman was found, she was lying naked on a plastic sheet for 7 years, nonverbal. She was unable to walk, incontinent, and totally reliant on her siblings for all her daily care. The ARC was notified of this woman's condition after she had been taken to the hospital with life-threatening skin infections and was no longer able to take food by mouth. The ARC petitioned for emergency guardianship, advocated and consented to medical treatment, secured additional support service, and placed her in a group home where today she's thriving, and we're just so thrilled with her outcome. And that's just one story of many that we could tell you about. Since that time, we continue to advocate for the siblings that remain still in the home, and we look forward to seeking protective services for that individual, those individuals. So we would just like to reiterate that we support this bill, and thank you for this time, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Given the time, we'll...
Thank you.
We'll pass. Yes, please.
Chair Greenlick, members of the subcommittee. My name is Charles Wright, and I'm a member of the Lane County Mental Health Advisory Committee. This is advisory to the county commissioners. I've participated for a number of years in working on trying to establish a public guardianship program in Lane County. And I've given you the 3-minute version. You can read that in 3 minutes, and we'll give you the 1-minute précis. And I'm going to tell you some things you haven't heard already this afternoon. One of the problems of aging is that as we get older, we lose capacity, perhaps, and you can imagine people needing guardians from that. I represent an entirely different category of people, the parents, the aging parents of the people who currently don't have guardians because the parents can take care of them. What happens to those folks when their parents aren't there anymore? This is the big, big problem. And if there aren't family members available, as in our case, there aren't, what will become of my wife's son with schizophrenia? It's something that terrifies me and the other family members in the Alliance for Mental Illness. We've just heard that the developmentally disabled parents have the same problem. They have the ARC. We don't have anything like that. There is nothing like that. We've been working for a number of years in Lane County to set up something. We have every year run into the problem that the county doesn't have any money. Well, you know what happened to the ONC money this year. The situation is worse and worse. Without state support, there simply will be no public guardianship program in Lane County or in any of the other ONC counties, for that matter. It won't happen. The order of magnitude that you're talking about here, $100,000, is about right. This is the kind of money that it takes to make this sort of thing happen. Without it, it simply will not happen.
Thank you. Four of my five best friends are in exactly the same situation you're talking about. It's a desperate situation. Thanks for your testimony. One of the issues, and I guess we just need to name it, is it's going to be one thing to get $2 million out of the Ways and Means Committee for this year. The sense is this needs to be an ongoing amount to those counties. It's going to be an even bigger problem as it rolls up in the future. Yes?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Timothy Martin. I'm an attorney in private practice in Forest Grove, Oregon. I've been practicing in the area of law of probate protective proceedings for a little over 10 years now. That doesn't make me an expert by any means, but I'm somewhat familiar with the issues. I could tell you half a dozen war stories to match and add to you've already heard today. I'll spare you that. We're certainly, as a society, we're facing a train wreck because we've got more aging people. With the baby boomers getting older, we have statistically there's more incidence of dementia on the rise, more incidences of autism on the rise, and there are not enough qualified people who are able to serve as guardians and conservators, and there's not enough money to fund those kinds of services at this point. It's an observation. I noticed all the people of the medical community kind of departed after the last testimony. If they had any idea how much money this bill would save them, they would have all been here testifying in favor of it, because by getting a guardian in place, you actually have somebody that can be a decision maker, that can get somebody on a good medical course of treatment so that you're not constantly administering emergency medical services, which is extraordinarily expensive. One example I have is a guy who was a chronic alcoholic. He had a couple of dozen different police calls on him all the time, and they take him to the psych ward, they treat him. Those kinds of services, not only do they not help the person, they just cost us as a society a tremendous amount of money. We should have this room crowded with people saying we need to spend this money, because not only is it a good use of money to make our society better, but we're going to save a whole lot of money. It occurs to me that there really are two kinds of cases that fall through the cracks. The one kind of case is where there's insufficient funds, and the other kind of case where you just don't have somebody qualified to serve as a guardian. This kind of a program would be a stopgap for both of these. And I want to say, as an observation, this really is a Band-Aid. It's a very necessary Band-Aid, but the problem is immense. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all very much. Thank you for bringing this bill to us. Thank you for waiting until 5 o'clock to testify. We really very much appreciate your effort. I think we will move it to Ways and Means. Whether we get out of Ways and Means is a big problem there. Now I'm looking for something like $400 million to balance the budget, but we'll see what we can do with it. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, Representative Greenlick, last session I served on the Veterans Committee, and it was interesting because we heard the cries about our returning veterans just like this, because if we could just get them pointed in the right direction. And, you know, we had to work hard to look at where we're going to fund it from, but I think we really need to support funding for this. So.
Yes, we did. All right. We have a quorum? Yeah, we do. I think I would like to move this to full to full today. Let me close the public hearing on HB 3342 and open a work session on HB 3342. I'll take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3342 to full committee with due pass.
We have a motion in front of us. Any discussion?
No.
Would you call the roll, please, Aaron?
Aye.
Excused.
Vice Chair Tanis.
excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. We'll schedule it for the next full committee meeting we have with the idea of moving it on to Ways and Means. And thank you all very much. Representative Richardson will carry it to the full. Close the work session on 3342 and adjourn the House Committee on Healthcare, Subcommittee on Healthcare Access.